everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're very pleased to have Simon Morrison on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, The People's Artists, Prokofiev's Soviet Years. You've probably heard Prokofiev's music. Peter and the Wolf is the most famous composition, probably to most Americans, and you probably didn't know that he had a fascinating life. Part of it he spent in Russia, and then he traveled to the West, and then he returned to the Soviet Union in the unfortunate year of 1935, where he lived to the end of his life. Very little was actually known about Prokofiev's Soviet years before the intrepid Simon entered the Russian archives and dug up a lot of new information about him, and I have to tell you that that information sheds a lot of new light on Prokofiev's work in the Soviet Union, his musical productions there. It's a tale that you have, in a sense, heard before, that of an artist struggling with the communist powers that were to get his artistic work done. And Prokofiev had some triumphs and some tragedies. But what's most interesting about the book is that his personality really comes out, as does the relationship between that personality and the Soviet authorities and his music. It's a terrific book. I highly recommend that you read it, and I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Simon.
Hi, Marshall.
How are you today?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well. Things are very nice here in Iowa. How are things in New Jersey?
Very cold suddenly today. The weather has changed a lot, and it's been sort of blustery, and right now it's around zero.
Yeah, well, that's, that's a good, it's good weather to study in. That's what I always say.
Exactly.
That's why I don't live in California. I did live in California. I never got anything done there. It was terrible.
That's what they say. That's what they say. If you take a teaching job there, the first year, forget it.
I never got. I had to leave. I had to leave the state, really, to get my dissertation done. I just out of there, man.
Well, that's why Russia's a good place to work.
Exactly.
You get a lot done.
Yeah. So anyway, I should tell our listeners that we have Simon Morrison on the show today, and we'll be talking about his terrific new book, The People's Artist, Prokofiev's Soviet Years. It's just come out, so we're obviously very pleased to have him. And let me begin by asking you, Simon, to say a few words about yourself, where you grew up, where you went to school, how you became interested in music and music history, that sort of thing.
Sure. I was actually born in the UK, and but at a very young age, around five, my parents emigrated to Canada for work, to Western Canada. And my father, who was a sort of hospital administrator, and my mother was a nurse, they settled outside of Winnipeg, which is very cold indeed.
Yeah.
And in this town called Selkirk, which is notorious as probably considered one of the most disreputable towns in the Western Hemisphere. I grew up there, and I went through high school and became interested in just in playing in the band in studying music. I was actually a tuba player.
Really?
The percussion work, piano, tuba. And I wanted to study music, and I applied to what I regarded at the time as the best music school in the country, and got in based on this tuba audition, which was the University of Toronto. And I studied there and graduated in 1987. And it was during that period where I actually had inclination to go into performance, but recognizing that the audition circuit for tuba players and the possibility of getting a job is fairly remote, I became interested in the academic side first, education, and then I went into history, and I was bitten by that bug. And after I graduated, I worked, I thought I should work for a while, get some income, sort of be in an office, have a regular job. So I worked for a year and a half in an arts granting organization in Toronto, and after that went out to McGill and continued studying music history. And I took, towards the end of my undergraduate years, I took one course as a sort of language requirement in Russian, and I really loved it, but sort of forgot about it. But when I went to McGill, I started to pick it up again. And then I did something which was sort of strange. I applied for a grant to actually visit Russia as part of a group and just do a little immersion at the sort of beginning level of the language. And I went there for just a couple of weeks initially, and then got another grant and actually spent a long time there and sort of fully immersed.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the beginning of the Yeltsin period, so it was fairly desperate and very chaotic. But I basically lived in Moscow for a year, and you know, was immersing in the language, having a lot of crazy experiences traveling around places mm-hmm. I shouldn't go. And, mm-hmm. and I sat in on some of the courses of the conservatory and so forth. From there, I went to Princeton University. I applied while I was in Moscow to graduate
mm-hmm.
school.
Mm-hmm.
And I did my doctorate here at Princeton.
Mm-hmm. MC. Mm-hmm. And do you still play the tuba?
No. No,
oh,
I play the piano.
Oh,
I have a piano at home, but no tuba. No, the tuba, I think, was abandoned at McGill, somewhere in the basement.
That's too bad.
So it's not in the picture. You know, it'd be more sort of, you know, a better anecdote if it were somehow stored in the basement of the Paris Opera. But
yeah.
No, it's somewhere in the bowels of McGill.
Well, the tuba is the king of instruments. I mean, there's, you know, I mean, it's a tuba. It's a really, you know, a thing. You know.
Yeah, and I had a wild one. I mean, yeah. In order to adjust the tuning, I had some welding done.
I hope
bizarre. By the time I was done with it was a dented bizarre apparatus, which sounded pretty good.
I really hope that this spawns a whole new generation of tuba players. I honestly do. So let's move on to this. Was Prokofiev the subject of your dissertation then?
No, my dissertation was on the symbolist movement
mm-hmm.
in Russia. So it was on the turn of the century, into
mm-hmm.
the 20th century, and it was about a group of operas and their relationship with, you know, mysticism and trends in literature that had to deal with the otherworldly.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was an aesthetics study. One of the chapters concerned Prokofiev, his outlandish opera about the supernatural called The Fiery Angel, which has a symbolist novel as its source,
mm-hmm.
but it's a parodic treatment of the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just one small chapter on it. The rest of it had to deal with Rimsky-Korsakov, primarily Scriabin,
mm-hmm.
and there was also an early chapter on Tchaikovsky.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was in, I think it was when I was in an undergraduate, which is about the same time you were, and I remember that one of Scriabin's progeny used to make ads for scotch. Do you remember these? Honestly, because I had a Russian professor. He's like, look, this is what's happened to the Scriabin family. They make ads for scotch.
Well, undoubtedly.
I said, great. You know, however you make ends meet. So in any event, how did you decide to write this particular biography of Prokofiev's Soviet years?
Somewhat by chance. For about 15 years now, I've been going to Moscow and trolling around in the various federal archives.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have a great love for Prokofiev's music from the start. I always had this from
uh-huh.
just growing up, my father listening to it. And I, just in my early dissertation work, when I was doing this chapter on this one opera and a couple of articles, and then eventually a performance project I did here at Princeton University, which was a revival of a Prokofiev ballet,
uh-huh.
I sort of got to know the Prokofiev holdings in Moscow and was fascinated by the fact that half of them were closed.
Uh-huh.
Half of them are closed in one of the biggest archives in Moscow, and a good portion of the holding is closed at another smaller museum archive. And through a fairly protracted period of not negotiation, but also just befriending and working with the Prokofiev estate on performance-related projects, including this ballet staging and then a play staging with some of his incidental music, I gradually got access to some of the musical materials that were sealed.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, working with the family as well as with the head of the archive in question, the director
mm-hmm.
of the archive in question, which is the Russian State Archive of Literature and Art,
mm-hmm.
I eventually got access to most of the sealed side of the archive, the personal materials in that, as well as
mm-hmm.
the political materials.
Mm-hmm.
So from that, once that archive opened up to me, I realized immediately that I needed to kind of abandon the project I was working on, which was a study on ballet
mm-hmm.
in the 20s, and actually take this on because it was just such an amazing opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And from that, after over the course of 5 years, I put together this book.
That's funny because that's what I tell all my students. I say, you have plan X. Go into
yeah.
the archive. You will come out with plan Y.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about archives. I mean, irrespective of their reputation to the outside world, they're living places
yeah.
full of, you know, wonderful spirits.
Yeah, no, it's
you know, I was the one thing I'll say about this archive, which was truly for me one of these beguiling attractions, was if you go in there and you know everything is cataloged in these binders,
mm-hmm.
and you can so see what belongs to Prokofiev. So there's these four big binders, and you go through them, and they say available, not available, you know, to be given out, not to be given out. And so you can just go down the list and see what's open and what's closed. So most of the personal letters are closed. But the interesting thing is there are four of these catalogs, and they are numbered as follows, 1, 2, 3, and 5. So the question arises, like, so, what's catalog number 4, where is it? And that's the amazing one. That's the one that is completely off limits. It's invisible because it's basically comprised of materials that aren't even reproduced. The archive only has single copies of them. They're not properly cataloged, and they are completely taboo, completely off limits to researchers.
Did you get a chance to look at those?
Yes, after a while. But what I did was I sort of got I got from the archive the structure of it, and then I requested specific things. A lot of the material in there had to do with Prokofiev's early life, you know, his letters to his mother, old girlfriends, and so on. So it wasn't of interest to me for this project. But there were certain things to do with Romeo and Juliet, which the original version with the happy ending, which is what I remember with Mark Morris Dad's group.
Right.
Some documents about that there were in that I sort of retrieved.
Yeah, that's a terrific story. Yeah, no, there's really a terrific archive.
Well, it's typical of the sort of Russia, you know, all secrets are sort of out there or known, you know.
No, that's very quite true. So let's just launch into Prokofiev's life. Now, your book itself, I should tell the readers, is really primarily about Prokofiev's Soviet years, and he goes back in, what is it, 35, is that right?
35 almost permanently, and then 36 the door closes.
But if you could just give us a kind of brief summation of his life to that point, that would be great.
Sure. He was born in Ukraine in a small town, a hamlet called Sansovka. His father was looked after land, looked after an estate. His mother was educated him in piano. He went to the child prodigy. He had Mozartian gifts. He went to the St. Petersburg Conservatory very early on. Series of piano teachers, worked with Rimsky-Korsakov, was a bit of an enfant terrible within the conservatory system, creating both traditional works but also some more outlandish experimental ones. Then, upon graduation, he aligned himself with Diaghilev and the Ballet Russe organization, which was in Paris, and he was mentored and also established a rivalry with Stravinsky, composed to mixed results a series of ballets for that organization. Traveled from there, seeking basically new opportunities. He traveled from there to the United States. His actual first trip outside of Russia was major trip was to the United States. So he, unlike other Russian emigres, actually ended up going east. He went through Japan and ended up in California, whereas the rest of them sort of flooded out to Germany and France and England. So he went back and forth in mid-career. Sort of early mid-career, between Western Europe and America. In Chicago, he composed his best-known opera, which is The Lover of Three Oranges. He performed a lot of tempestuous recitals to, you know, audience incredulity. And he had a fairly rocky career. It was one with great successes occasionally, certainly great performing successes. Personally, it was probably more successful for him than professionally because he met his first wife. They had two children, and he basically established a household in Paris, but, you know, fundamentally had to earn income by traveling, concertizing. He was always frustrated by the fact that he had to travel incessantly. It was exhausting for him as he sort of approached his middle years. And he began in the early 1930s to receive, well, actually earlier than that, in the late 1920s, to receive very strong overtures from Soviet Russia. And at this point in time, the Stalinist regime was interested in bringing back Russian cultural celebrities who had left. And so there was a campaign that was sort of put out step by step, mobilized to bring him back home. He was always interested in this because there was an element of homesickness within him. He also realized that whereas he had floundered to some degree in competition with Stravinsky, the United States was a little bit hostile to him early on, and he also found himself to some degree in competition there with Rachmaninoff. And so the idea of going back to Russia, which he considered to be his home country, where he could conceivably be the big fish in the pond, was attracted to him. Plus the idea that what he was offered by Soviet authorities was, you know, lucrative commissions, steady work without having to concertize, Best of all, he was guaranteed performances of big works, operas, and ballets. And bit by bit, this set of lures became more and more attractive to him, to a certain point, to the point at which he was basically receiving, by the early 30s, most of his income out of Soviet Russia. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, the authorities notified him to the extent that we can no longer give you these commissions unless, in fact, you relocate.
Mm-hmm.
And the fatal move for him, you know, at the time, it seemed like a good idea, because for him, Paris was a home. It was not the home, because he was fraternizing with a Russian emigre community.
Mm-hmm.
Paris at this point in time was not particularly welcoming to foreigners.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, political developments in the early 30s in Western Europe were ominous, mm-hmm. as they were obviously in Russia. And he made a gamble, and he accepted these lures from the Soviets on the basis that they promised him that, you know, all we're asking you to do is shift your sphere of operations,
mm-hmm.
to move from Paris to Moscow, where the work is, but mm-hmm. still you'll be Mr. International, you'll be Mr. Mm-hmm. Cosmopolitan,
mm-hmm.
But you're just going to where it's more convenient for you, essentially. He thought about it, he wavered, but his wife, Lena Prokofiev, who's not Russian, she actually grew up in the New York area, she sort of convinced him that this would be a good thing to do, it would be essentially a good career move. And the final nudge, was one that was fateful indeed. In early 1936, Prokofiev was back in Paris, having spent this wonderful summer in outside of Moscow composing Romeo and Juliet. They were packing to make the final move, and this musical political storm erupted in Moscow because Shostakovich was denounced in the media for his opera Lady
Macbeth. Mm-hmm.
And rather than seeing this as an ominous signal, which it was, about crackdown on any sort of experimentalism in music, Prokofiev and his wife actually saw it as an opportunity that he could, in fact, arrive in Moscow and be immediately the number one composer.
Mm-hmm.
And in that miscalculation, it was the beginning of the rest of his life.
Mm-hmm. Let me answer one question that I had about a period earlier in his life, and there's a note in the book. It's just a couple of words actually, but it kind of piqued my interest. And that is that when he left the Soviet Union, he had the blessing of Lunacharsky, and I just wondered exactly how did he find himself getting the blessing of Lunacharsky, and what were his political sympathies at the time that he left?
He left revolutionary Russia. He left in 1919, and with the establishment of the Leninist regime, the Leninist government, Anatoly Lunacharsky was put in charge of enlightenment, cultural enlightenment. And Prokofiev, what's interesting about his story is when he left, the common take on him is he left like Stravinsky left. He left the country. He was no longer going to be Russian.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, he never planned on leaving for a long period in time. It just turned out that way.
Mm-hmm.
And what he basically got was, you know, permission from Lunacharsky, who was the Commissar of Enlightenment for sort of educational matters under Lenin, to leave the country on an extended tour.
Mm-hmm.
And this permission allowed him to get the necessary exit paperwork and the paperwork back into the country, and also allowed him to make contacts with foreigners who were in Russia at the time, including a fellow named Cyril McCormack, who became one of his first American sponsors. So this was the arrangement. Komandirovka was the word.
Right.
It basically it means business trip.
Yeah.
But you know, it was on the command of Lunacharsky that he was allowed to leave.
Yeah.
This is important because it meant there was official sanction for Prokofiev to leave, and the status he took with him abroad was that of a cultural diplomat, that he was somehow a representative for Russia and then Soviet Russia.
I should know this because I'm sure it's in the book. Did he maintain his Soviet citizenship throughout?
No, he left. He was, you know, at this period in time, the Soviet Union did not exist.
Uh-huh.
It was being formed, and he left basically without status,
uh-huh.
Which is these papers, and he ended up in Angel Island. He went
really?
Via Japan, Hawaii, ended up in Angel Island outside uh-huh. of California, and was put in basically a detention facility.
Uh-huh.
And he had to wait there for several days while they interrogated him, and then finally gave him a visa to enter the country.
Uh-huh. So he was a stateless person then?
Yeah, and then after that, through America, where he stayed, his first trip to America was protracted. It was about a year and a half, and then he went to Western Europe, reconnected with Diaghilev, there for several years he existed on a Nansen passport.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only with the establishment of the first Soviet embassy, which was the one in Paris,
mm-hmm.
That he actually got Soviet citizenship.
I see.
And basically, as soon as that facility opened, he went down there and got a passport.
Mm-hmm.
And his first return trip back, which was 8 years after he left, was in 1927, and after he went there on a Soviet passport.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, things got dicey for him because he was maintaining an identity certificate in Paris, a certificate
mm-hmm.
of identity,
mm-hmm.
As well as Soviet documentation. So
mm-hmm.
he had a Soviet passport. He was at this point regarded as a Soviet citizen, but living in France
mm-hmm.
on a temporary permit, which he had to renew every year.
Mm-hmm.
And because he concertized incessantly, he was moving all around Europe. He actually went to Northern Africa. He went,
mm-hmm.
just everywhere. Border crosses became very, very difficult for him. And so
mm-hmm.
There's a very thick file in Paris, with the police about him that
mm-hmm.
still exists. And you can actually just see, the kind of endless troubles he had crossing these various
mm-hmm.
borders, given his, strange status.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually investigated a couple of times.
Mm-hmm. No, I find it very interesting that he held fast to the notion that he would return to whatever that place was called when he returned to the Soviet Union in this case, because other composers, as you say, did not. How was he seen in the emigre community before and after he returned?
He was not. He wasn't part of the emigre community, and in fact, his primary circle of friends in Paris from the 20s onward were basically representatives from the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm.
He was somebody whose social life was not in the various Parisian salons,
mm-hmm.
the kind of
mm-hmm.
places that Stravinsky, Picasso,
yeah.
and frequented, but basically these
yeah.
soirees held at the embassies. And he befriended, from 1925 on, these various artists, experimental artists, products of the Cultural Revolution, who were interested in collaborating him on various projects. Thus, he teamed up with an Armenian artist named Yakulov on the ballet, which became the Steel Step Ballet. He also contemplated working on a dramatic setting of novels by various revolutionary poets and writers, including people like Afanasyev, who was one of, and Gorky, and these people that were coming out of the Soviet sphere. They were in Paris, associated with the embassy, correspondents for Pravda newspaper who were coming in and out, and he became part of that circle. And there was always this sort of pull back, and
mm-hmm.
He was always being propagandized, told how, on one hand, wonderful and exciting it was, and how many opportunities there was. And to some degree, he was also fascinated by what had happened to this country.
Mm-hmm.
He left Tsarist Russia. Basically, he was educated in Tsarist Russia. He left in a time of turmoil. He wondered when he was traveling to America whether or not it's like Russia would forgive him
mm-hmm.
for leaving at this time of crisis. And it was always this pull back.
Mm-hmm.
And so he never fully integrated into Western life, as did Stravinsky, as did
mm-hmm.
the other.
Mm-hmm.
He learned French beautifully. He spoke
mm-hmm.
English well. He knew German.
Mm-hmm.
He was polyglot, like his first wife
yeah.
was. He married a non-Russian.
Mm-hmm.
But he never abandoned his Russianness. And at one point in the early 30s, while he was trying to get going on his first cello concerto, he just complained that he just couldn't compose. He just couldn't compose anymore. He was blocked. He just needed some inspiration.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, I see. He seems, I don't really quite know how to characterize his political attitudes, but he seems somewhere between strangely apolitical, intentionally so, and just politically clueless. How would you characterize it?
Yeah, the general take on him is that he was politically naive. That's not true. He actually thought a lot about politics. He was curious about them. He was fascinated by Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't believe that he read it. He was fascinated by he was fascinated by Schopenhauer.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought about various political systems, but basically he thought of himself as a tremendously, a divinely gifted artist,
mm-hmm.
somehow above the fray.
Mm-hmm.
And when he made his moves, he thought in political terms.
Mm-hmm.
He decided that, he's going to go and ingratiate himself with the authorities, whoever the authorities are, in whatever way he needed to,
mm-hmm.
And basically do what he needed to in order to be, allowed to work in peace.
Mm-hmm.
But he also had a funny attitude about his music, which is a problem, I think, for historians and theorists alike, which is that he believed that, and this has to do with some of his spiritual sentiments, who's an active Christian scientist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we should talk about
that. He believed that, You know, he believed that his music was, you know, this product of this divine gift.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, it transcended kind of worldly concerns.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though he wrote a lot of political pieces, heinously political pieces, you know, a birthday tribute to Stalin,
mm-hmm.
cantatas to the revolution,
mm-hmm.
he somehow believed that the music associated with the words he set, you know, was unrelated to them, transcended them. So even though the music was busily representing these political ideas,
mm-hmm.
he thought, well, it didn't matter because the music was, you know, in a different sphere. The music could be detached from the words and attached to different words and so
mm-hmm.
forth. But so he had this kind of apolitical attitude to writing political works.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, this paradoxical state of mind is something that's difficult for us to grasp, but it was very important to him.
Yeah, I think you do a nice job in the book of suggesting just that. And it is difficult for us to grasp because, you know, especially I think historians, not musicologists, historians such as yourself, are so deeply involved in explicit political discourse. It's kind of hard to understand that somebody could think, well, you know, the product of my genius is for the ages and not for this or that passing political fancy.
He believed his music would be immortal, which turned out to be.
Yeah.
But, you know, but I think he fundamentally believed that, well, Stalinism will disappear and my music will live on.
Yeah.
He was right.
And I think, you know, I was never a genius tuba player such as yourself, but I did play in rock bands, and I can tell you that I met a lot of people who felt that about their music, that, you know, this or that would come and go, but, you know. And I just gave this lecture on romanticism, the genesis of romanticism, and I talked to the kids about Kurt Cobain, who I think thought the same thing. I mean, he thought he was writing music for the ages and thought that he was, you know, the kind of leader of his generation and all generations of young people, if you read his journals and things like this. And he dies this kind of cliched romantic death, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
It's sort of sad, but that's what it is. I mean, he really had, you know, there's actually a line in, I'm really showing my true colors now, there's a line in David Bowie, Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, where he says Ziggy sucked up into his mind. And I always think that's a really nice metaphor for this kind of romantic vision of transcendentalism, of sort of transcendental products of writing for the ages, you know, and thinking that you are really above it all. But I do definitely get the impression from reading the book that Prokofiev was not, it's not that he was oblivious to these things, but he really was above them. He didn't think, you know, that, you know, the slings and arrows of outrageous whatever, we're going to get other people, but not him.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that, you know, he treated people around him very badly at times.
Mm-hmm.
He did not treat his family well.
Yeah.
He abandoned them, in part for his work. And I think that he felt, on one hand, he had a tremendous sense of self. He was fairly fearless,
mm-hmm.
fairly. I mean, at a certain point, he felt fear, you know, after 1948. But early on, he was not going to tolerate being bullied by these Avanachiki politicians. So he just didn't fear it at all. But he was, I think, also recognized that his gift was truly preternatural. And to some degree, I line him up with the likes, I mean, in terms of his early innate childhood gift of Mozart, but
mm-hmm.
I sort of line him up with Tchaikovsky a little bit. I mean, Tchaikovsky was one of these artists who, you know, there's a lot of melancholic outpourings in his letters, and he's very emotional and down on himself often. And, it, you know, there's people read all sorts of nonsense into that about his, you know, sexuality and
mm-hmm.
psychology. But I think fundamentally Tchaikovsky recognized that he had this amazing gift and that he was sort of placed on this planet to serve it,
mm-hmm.
and that he needed to work as hard as possible in honor of that gift. And
mm-hmm.
he was similar in that regard. And I think when he ended his life, you know, he ended his death, his end was tragic.
Mm-hmm.
And he left an enormous amount of work sort of on the table, incomplete.
Mm-hmm.
He had a lot of ideas. And, you know, when he died, basically he turned to his second wife and just, he knew it was over. And he just basically said, you know, I could have composed so much more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, one of the things that comes out about him is he does have a strong work ethic. He produced and produced and produced. I mean, he does seem like, I was going to use the word workaholic, but that has negative connotations. And I certainly do. I have met, you know, actually in my athletic career, I have met people who could do things that I had almost never seen anyone do. And all they wanted to do was do them. You know, because that was what they were about. You know, I can do this incredible thing and almost nobody else can. If you'll just let me do it, you'll be entertained. And I certainly can. Again, I'm not one of these people, but I certainly can understand wanting to serve that gift. And I can really understand the kind of tangible frustration at what seemed to be these kind of petty interferences that he must have suffered throughout his life. But on the other hand, you know, in a kind of broader perspective, as you say, he and you're very gentle with him, I think. He does treat the people around him badly is probably too strong, but in a very mixed way. In other words, he neglects them, and then when they get in trouble, he tries to save them in a half-hearted attempt. He seems tortured, particularly about his first wife. Maybe you could talk a little about that.
Yeah, he suffered guilt. And, you know, just the one last thing before we turn to that about the, his political relationships and his attitude towards his artists. I think that in one strange, bizarre, perhaps perverse way, he liked the idea of taking these kind of terrible political commissions, because his mindset was, all right, you can give, you sort of Pushkin in this regard, you can give me any sort of literary trash, and I'll turn it into musical gold.
Yeah, right.
He kind of had that attitude, like, he could work this sort of magic.
Right.
Yeah, with regard to his separation from his first wife and his connection to second, this is like the rawest and most painful period in his existence, certainly in his first wife's existence, and for the family, the surviving family members, it's still extremely painful. The copy of the marriage, he married his first wife in 1924 after a long relationship. It seems he married her because she got pregnant. They had two children, two boys, and by the time they relocated from Paris to Moscow, one of them was in his teens, the other was getting there. The relationship deteriorated. It was deteriorated before they had relocated. One wonders if part of this relocation was, you know, one of these kind of reflexive moves to kind of re-energize the relationship through a change in surroundings. We don't know. We know that there were a lot of fights when they traveled, tremendous fights. The pressure of being in Stalinist Moscow is one that we cannot imagine. We know that people, even under Stalin, lived normal lives to some degree. They went on picnics. They had divorces. And Prokofiev found himself attracted to a lot of other women. And the relationship, the marriage deteriorated, and there are these startling anecdotes and interviews and letters in which Lena acknowledges the fact that she was terrified. And that in 1937, when they're living in this apartment in Moscow, which is, you know, a luxurious apartment by Moscow standards, people around them were being arrested during the Stalinist purges. Prominent people were being arrested. They heard this happening at night. And she said, "You promised me to him, you know, that if we didn't like it here, we could go back to Paris." And he said, "You know what I promised then, I can't do now anymore." And why he said that, we don't know the answer to that, but he really couldn't do anything. The thing that he was able to do was get them one last trip abroad. And the condition was that, yeah, the two of them could go abroad, tour, go to Europe, go to America, but the children had to stay in school as kind of hostages.
Yeah.
So this is what happened. He went on this final tour, and when he came back, that was it. The door closed permanently, no more travel abroad. And at this point, his in the summer, he went to this resort in the Caucasus with his wife, and he was attracted to a young, ambitious kind of graduate student in a translation program named Mira Mendelssohn, a kid with a, you know, very well-connected family, speaking. And she put her eyes on him and courted him, and he responded. She wooed him with the idea of various collaborative projects, her translations, doing an opera together. And this romance developed in a way that became known to Lena, which she tried to put a stop to. And it became one of these traditional, you know, standard sort of stories. And at a certain point, there was some flare-up in which one of two things happened. Either there was a tremendous argument with Lena that he just left for good, or else Mira threatened him with, you know, in some quasi-romantic way. And basically, he abandoned his wife and children. And so he had, what is strange for him is this Prokofiev was, you know, basically homeless for many years of his life, just traveling. Finally, he gets a home in Moscow, and then 2 years after that, he becomes homeless again, basically living in various places with his eventual second wife. They took a while for them to get married. He was staying with her parents, staying at the Dacha outside of Moscow, staying with friends. And his household, his second household with his second wife, was only established when the Second World War started. And the two of them were evacuated together. And he, at this point, obviously felt tremendous guilt about his children, about his first wife, and he vowed to support them in what all means possible, and he did that. He fulfilled that vow. He sent them money regularly. He tried to look after their housing. He got them care when they needed to. But Lena, the first wife, she was just left with nothing. She ended up working as a translator, which is a fascinating in its own right, because she worked for a translator of military intelligence during the war. She worked for the Soviet Information Bureau, and but she sank into extreme depression. She and the children all got very ill, and then afterwards, as a culmination of a long process, she petitioned and petitioned and petitioned for an exit visa to get out of there. That was impossible. But she continued to fraternize in places where she should not have been fraternizing. She visited the American Embassy, the British, and she was picked up. She was arrested and charged with various counts of, well, attempts to flee and treason, espionage, and was sentenced to 20 years in the penal camp system in the Gulag. This happened in 1948, which was a period in which Prokofiev himself was under suspicion and was castigated for his musical activities, and the children broke the news to him, to him and his eventual second wife, and I think he just, at that point, I think he just collapsed, and just, I mean, I know that he said to them, you know, what have I done, because she was defenseless, but she, you know, Lena had an extraordinary life. She stayed in the camps for 8 years. He died during her time in prison. She heard the news on the radio.
Yeah, that's a fascinating story. Why don't you tell that really quickly?
Well, she was sentenced to three or four camps, some of them which held foreigners, and in 1953, Prokofiev died on the same day as Stalin, within the same evening hour as Stalin, we now believe. The question isn't when he died, it's exactly when Stalin died. It's not exactly clear. Yeah. No one will ever tell us that. But the reports of his demise were delayed owing to the, you know, the orgy of weeping, mass hysteria surrounding Stalin. But the news of Prokofiev's death was actually broadcast on radio from Argentina, of all things, where some of his music was being performed, and Lena heard it in the camp. And according to one of her friends in the camp who actually provided me an interview, she just silently began to weep and walked away. She was released from the camps in 1956 under Khrushchev during the period of destalinization of that society. She was looked after by the head of the Union of Soviet Composers, who got her a one-room apartment. She stayed in Moscow until 1974. Both of her children were there, but her youngest son, Oleg, defected, having married a foreigner who was in Moscow. And then she petitioned to leave as well and got an exit visa to go to a festival, and she herself defected. And she lived in Paris primarily, but visited her younger son, who ended up in London, and she died in 1989, shortly after doing a final recording of Peter and the Wolf at Lincoln Center. So, an amazing life, more amazing than his, and it's something that, in terms of its details, is something I don't think any novelist would dare contrive, but very strong person, obviously.
Yeah, it really is a remarkable life. I have to, you know, again, it's funny because Prokofiev served his own genius. In a sense, she served his genius, too. Not willingly.
Well, she was a you know, a mid-level singer, and I say that generously. She probably wasn't a strong voice, but so she became involved with a famous musician, you know, one of those famous musicians in the world, and went along with it.
Yeah.
And she was not the gatekeeper, the sort of secretarial support that his second wife became. But she was, you know, an individual. She was had her own artistic ambitions, but she, you know, teamed up with him. They did a lot of recitals together. She, you know, wanted her own life. She was somewhat of a society person, and liked the glamour of Paris. Paris spoiled her greatly, and you know, that fractured. Eventually, fractured.
It's a horrible analogy, but I'll confess that my popular culture addled mind immediately went to it when I read about Mira, was her name, right?
Yeah.
That she was much more Yoko-like than Lena was.
Yeah, well, you know, the funny thing about her is there was always this sense in the Cold War legacy that his second wife was somehow, you know, it was a setup. It was a political setup.
Yeah.
But she was, there was all rumors that she was, the daughter of the niece of Stalin. Uh-huh. It was one of the popular ones. Her father was a statistician, economist. Mm-hmm. Her mother helped build the subway in Moscow.
Yeah.
She was a good kind of, communist young person, but her parents actually wanted her to stay out of the political life. So they put her into literary school.
Yeah.
But she was, 24 years younger.
Yeah, exactly.
Talk about her.
No, I mean, I think
it was a midlife crisis.
Yeah, no, she. I mean, reading the account in your book, I mean, she comes off as a very genuine, sort of artistically inspired person, in love with Prokofiev deeply, and dedicated to him. And she really is a kind of true believer in his genius, and she wants to help him, and he allows her to help him. And so, I mean, it does seem like a kind of a love match. I mean, that's what it looks like.
Yeah, it was an ideal companionship. I mean, by the time Prokofiev suffered from extreme high blood pressure, and by the time they were together, I think he was in poor health, and I think she tended to him on that front as well. And, one of the... It couldn't have been great after Lena was released from prison,
mm-hmm.
Because the two women were in Moscow together,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think they fraternized. But, during this period, after Lena was released, she, with extreme energy, went to get her reputation back, including mm-hmm. her rights to Prokofiev's...
Right.
heritage and her status as his legal wife, which was actually rescinded.
Mm-hmm.
So, it could not have been great between the two. The Mira, the reports on her, it makes most people have to think she was actually a wonderful person. A distinguished colleague of mine, Malcolm Brown, is now retired,
mm-hmm.
Works in Russian music at Indiana University. He is the only person I know from the West who actually met Mira.
Oh, really?
There in the 60s. Hmm. And he said he could understand the appeal. I mean, he knew both. He met both of them. And,
mm-hmm.
Did a lot of interviews with them. And said Miri had one interview with her. She was extremely nervous.
Mm-hmm.
It was just not a kind of contact she wanted to have. Whereas Lena was very open.
Mm-hmm.
He had a very good impression of her.
Yeah.
She ended up, she lived with her father until he died, and she died alone. They found mm-hmm. her literally with she had collapsed while on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
They found her dead with the phone.
That's horrible. That's horrible. So why don't we spend a few minutes, this is really my weak point, I have to say, to talking about Prokofiev's music after he came back in 1935. And I wanted to start with kind of a general question, because I should tell those people that are very interested in Prokofiev's music and music in general that that many of the pages of the book are given over to descriptions of Prokofiev's compositions themselves and attempts to characterize them kind of vis-a-vis one another and vis-a-vis the broader musical context. It strikes me that this kind of thing is extraordinarily difficult. How did you approach it?
I approached it basically, I was writing a biography, but I felt I needed to acknowledge the craft
mm-hmm.
That this person had dedicated himself to,
mm-hmm.
Trained in music theory. I've done a lot of manuscript work over the years, including, restoring some of his compositions,
mm-hmm.
putting them back together after they've been sort of, scattered amongst different archives.
Mm-hmm.
So what I basically discovered in writing this book is actually we don't actually know the entire Prokofiev work list. And so one of my duties was discuss all of the works he composed
mm-hmm.
In order and... why some of them were banned and why some of them never got performed and why some of them were reworked and retitled
mm-hmm.
and mashed up in different ways. And so primarily my duty was just actually creating a chronology of his life.
Mm-hmm.
This was somebody whose work was his life, was to basically provide the chronologies of all of these big compositions
mm-hmm.
as well as some of the smaller ones. And I found that the stories of some of these compositions, like Romeo and Juliet, like Cinderella, like The Last Symphony, were fascinating in their own right because they were so politically fraught.
Mm-hmm.
They were so interfered with by various levels of the Soviet bureaucracy that by actually going through each of these compositions and talking about their genesis, one really got a sense of how Soviet music worked,
mm-hmm.
who paid for these things, how they were controlled, who censored them, who didn't, who promoted them, and the interactions between various musicians. I mean, there was still a lot of questions that, I've yet to answer about
mm-hmm.
Prokofiev's contacts and commissions, but I worked hard to get a lot of those answers, and so I became fascinated just by the chronologies of his works, and then his compositional process, which I found really quite remarkable because he, despite the fact that he collaborated incessantly, despite the fact that he always seemed to need somebody to tell him what to do, he needed a kind of, you know, superego filmmaker or director or even politician to sort of guide his compositional energies. He would just take a he would just work in isolation. So he would read the source play that he was writing music to and then sit down and within a day or two write it up.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that Peter and the Wolf, you know, his most famous work, became famous in his own time, was something that he just whipped up and
I found it incredible. Just truly amazing.
On a whim, that kind of, I just found just to describe that kind of gift is just fascinating.
I imagine.
But the fact that he did all of that while traveling, living out of suitcases, under enormous pressure, unwell, it just seemed unbelievable.
Yeah, no, I agree, especially the last part, because he does travel all the time. And I got to tell you that, like, just speaking personally, and there are certain times and places where I can work, and they are very few.
Yeah.
If you sent me in a hotel room someplace in Cleveland, I could do no productive work, none, and I'd just be too.
Yeah,
I'd
just go to the Starbucks.
Yeah, right. I probably would too, and there I wouldn't do anything, but I'd get to look at things. But yeah, I just found it absolutely astounding the degree to which he could apparently concentrate and be
productive. And he would work with no materials. I mean, half of his career was begging for manuscript paper.
That's amazing.
So you look at. Cinderella is a major 20th century composition. It's a celebrated ballet. You look at the state of that manuscript, and it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It's like different size paper all torn up. It's just written on scraps. It's quite amazing. The survival of this material is also testament to him because he was very good at the end of his life when he sensed it.
Yeah.
Packaging up these scores and putting them in.
But let's talk a little bit about, one of the fascinating things that I found in your book is, we have this kind of, and I study Russian Soviet history, and I also have this kind of cliched stereotype of a kind of top-down command-type administrative system where, somebody at the very top says X, and it goes down through a series of dispatches, and everybody toes the party line. But I think you do a nice job of describing how none of that was really necessary, that a signal could be sent from the top, and then everybody would sense immediately what it meant. And, for example, commissions would be withdrawn, or performances would be canceled, this kind of thing. And that really there was a lot of kind of unspoken activity going on in the way in which Soviet music worked. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I mean, it has to do, I think it stems just in terms of how Stalin operated. I mean, we don't have access to the presidential archive, of course, but there's a lot of duplication in the archive system. You get a sense of how Stalin operated by looking at other archives. And, most of it was oral resolutions. Very little was written down. So in terms of the big liquidations, the biggest monstrous crimes, there's probably no document with his hand on it, his signature on it. So these oral resolutions and these things that are just not written down were the ways in which important decisions were disseminated. But there were certain sort of sly ways in which big signals could be sent. So when Prokofiev, like Shostakovich and five others, got into political hot water in 1948, mostly because they were getting a lot of financial perks, the Central Committee sort of published a list of works that couldn't be performed by Shostakovich or Prokofiev.
Mm-hmm.
And the list is completely random and chaotic. It's it doesn't make any sense. You look at, some of them said, why would you ban that? It's like politically completely correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that you can understand. But the idea was like, list a few works in a random way and the signal is don't perform anything.
Right.
So this kind of thing was easy to interpret. But the system, there was a sort of watchdog organization that controlled everything called the Committee on Arts Affairs. And then beneath that, there were various unions, there were various bureaus, committees on censorship, on the theaters. And in a way, you had this sort of multi-kind of organization system where the controls were so strict that, you'd have these organizations which sort of check on one another as well as the artists that they were working with. So you could have certain work, if it was an opera, being vetted on the libretto side by one committee, musically by a union, musically by the theater, and then musically by the Committee on Arts Affairs, and even higher if needed be. If it was a work that concerned Stalin, then there'd be a special office, in the Kremlin that would look after the cult of personality.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just like this endless series of checks. And at a certain point towards the late Stalinist period, which is like the worst of all times in terms of mind control, you had this paralysis just creeping into the system where no one would do anything, mm-hmm. and everything would just get bound up in an endless series of checking and rechecking and mm-hmm. requests for smaller and smaller changes.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the case, this is the story of War and Peace,
mm-hmm.
that opera, which is, you know, it's in multiple versions, and by the end, Prokofiev was just haggling over two measures,
mm-hmm.
you know, of the score and losing his mind. And
mm-hmm.
so the basic point was that it was never going to get performed.
Mm-hmm.
The system was stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And it took Stalin's death for the, you know, things to unfreeze.
Mm-hmm. So Prokofiev falls out of favor in 48, is that correct, after this resolution?
Yeah.
And then he attempts, and this is a very interesting story, which is what I'm leading you to, he attempts to rehabilitate himself by writing... it's an opera, isn't it?
Yeah.
Called Story of a Real Man, or I can't remember.
Yeah, exactly. Story of a Real Man.
Yeah, maybe you could tell that story. Because I found that, I felt his frustration. I just, that was horrible. Go ahead and tell the story.
It's terrible. For his entire career is about trying to create, you know, an opera that would succeed no matter where he was in America or Soviet Union. In 1948, decree comes out, which punishes a sort of minor composer for his musical sins, his ideological sins, and basically says, well, the reason for this is to do with the influence from the senior composers. And so the whole group of elite Soviet composers, Prokofiev, Shostakovich, Miaskovsky, Chatrian, they were all castigated. And basically, for a time, their works were all pulled from the repertoire,
mm-hmm.
and the commission stopped. Prokofiev was beginning work on an opera. He sensed this storm brewing, and he began work on an opera that he thought was the subject of subjects. It was the most contemporary thing he could find. It was the most explicit example of political correctness, and he decided, and it was sort of a mad idea, to create an opera about a living character who had been novelized. It's the story of a pilot during World War II who had crashed and lost his legs. Had been amputated beneath the knee. He's saved by villagers. He rehabilitates himself. He's in the hospital, this character, after this operation. He's depressed, suicidal, but there's an old Bolshevik next to him. The hospital sort of bucks him up and says, look, you know, you can overcome this. And he says, how? You know, look at me. He says, no, you can fly again. He says, how? Look at me. He says, well, but yeah, you're not just an ordinary man. You're a Soviet.
All right, yeah. Exactly.
So this parable is constructed about this real-life person who had in fact gotten terribly injured and recovered and flew again and was turned into this ideological parable, published, widely disseminated. Prokofiev read it, thought it was trash, but second wife said, you know, this might work. He got some further advice. He began to compose it, and he decided to compose a work that would be full of all sorts of popular ditties, marches, and sing-alongs, and you know, great tunes.
And he goes and he poaches his own canon in order to bring it. He kind of
picks
the cherries out of it.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, it creates a sort of anthology opera. But then this crackdown takes place, and no matter what he did, it was going to get banned. And so there was this, shambles of a performance, of a run-through of this thing that was put on for officials in Leningrad. And, everyone just stood up and said that he was mocking.
Yeah. No.
And he was creating a parody. He was creating a comic book of an opera, and he just left the scene in very bad health at this period of time, and he was just frustrated to the point of despair. He just I just don't understand.
Yeah, exactly.
He didn't understand why the performance was just terrible.
Yeah.
Didn't even sound like him. I think they just.
And that's really the point.
I read it, and then he just I just don't understand.
To me, that was the really poignant part of it. Is it, obviously a brilliant person. If somebody would have set him the task of producing a good parody of this kind of socialist realism, I'm sure he could have done a brilliant job. But he does it by accident. He does it by almost unintentionally, and that's how the system twisted him so badly that he didn't understand what had happened. I mean, it really is it's an amazing.
Well, and in a way, this is where he doesn't have control over his own gift.
Yeah.
It's always already with him going to have this tart edge and have this kind of wickedly humorous edge, and so he just couldn't compose a different way.
Right.
This is why in certain genres, like creating a good mass chorus, he never succeeded,
mm-hmm.
whereas, his other composers did very well at that. It was an easy thing to do. He just couldn't do it,
mm-hmm, that's right.
even though he tried and tried and tried. And this opera was a great example of a work that's, a lot of chorus. It's kind of an oratorio.
Yeah.
It just failed. It blew up on him.
Yeah.
That he never recovered from it, except he did try he abandoned it, but he did start working on another work, which is kind of going to be the Soviet version of Così fan tutti.
Yeah.
He got through a scene, and it's actually the music's pretty good.
So he
gave up on it.
Take us through the last years of his life.
The last years of his life, this is interesting. The last years of his life, which are the last 5 years, he's in terrible health. He suffered this political crisis. Commissions for the major theaters, the orchestras, have all been withdrawn. He's impoverished temporarily owing to the fact that this country house that he had bought on a loan suddenly became due in full, the loan, and he had no money. This is part of one of the punishments, is the sort of the fact that he got this interest-free loan for this place. So he had to, in a way, he was too unwell to care about the political pressure he was facing, but a lot of his minders, handlers, the people who got a lot of work out of him and were able to sort of sustain themselves, convinced him to take on various minor projects. Mm-hmm. And he got some work in the final years from the radio committee, mm-hmm. Which performed a lot of works for broadcast and a lot of works for children, which is the privileged class in the Soviet sphere.
Mm-hmm.
And then he became, this is one of the interesting stories, he became involved with a young virtuoso cellist named Rostropovich, who was 22 when they met, who had taken on one of his pieces and performed it, a concerto. He performed it with a piano accompaniment at a big recital. This was a prize-winning cellist.
Mm-hmm.
And Rostropovich, at a certain point, was put in contact by Prokofiev. Now, that seemed kind of sinister. Right? Like, why didn't they just meet and start working together and have this kind of happy kind of collaboration? Well, I've learned in the course of this research that not to believe in fairy tales like that anymore. And somebody authorized this contact.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody decided that Prokofiev was too valuable to sort of be left to flounder, and that we should work with this brilliant virtuoso cellist who was representing the Soviet artistry in its greatest guise. He was allowed to travel abroad,
mm-hmm.
and that this collaboration would work for both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And Prokofiev at this point was not allowed to travel. Clearly, he was banned from travel. Rostropovich was already beginning to go to the West, which was like going to the moon under Stalin.
Mm-hmm.
So this they were put into contact, and I've seen letters. There are a few of them that are available, and the Rostropovich archive is basically closed because it's in the family's hands still.
Mm-hmm.
But you see Rostropovich sending letters to Prokofiev, encouraging him to write for him, encouraging him to do this, that, and the other. And this collaboration starts, and the first thing that happens is the two of them rework Prokofiev's first cello concerto into a second concerto. He does a sonata for cello. He does a symphony concerto for cello. And at the end of his life, Prokofiev has reverted back to, gone right back to Bach. He started working on a solo cello piece. And this is, at the end of his career in these collaborations with Rostropovich, Prokofiev's sort of final trip, is a trip back in time. It's no longer in geographical space.
Mm-hmm.
He reverts back to the kind of infant bliss, I guess, musically.
Mm-hmm.
Associated with Bachian style.
Mm-hmm.
So his final works, unplanned but unrealized, were all a la Bach.
Mm-hmm.
He left, his legacy was going to conclude with, a work for two piano concerto, solo for a sonata for unaccompanied cello, and a concertino for cello, et cetera, et cetera. There was this whole turn to Bach as a big escape, I think, creatively, was marking his end.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, this is actually a nice segue into my penultimate question. Actually,
sure.
About people like me who don't really follow classical music associate Prokofiev with, really, quite honestly, a kind of children's music. But it seems to me that his legacy is actually much richer. How would you characterize the way in which he's remembered, and is there any attempt going on to kind of revive his more serious pieces in the American or international mind?
It depends where you speak. In the United States, his operas are finally getting some recognition. The Metropolitan Opera is performing a lot of them. There were a couple of them in the repertoire last year.
Really?
The Gambler and War and Peace.
Oh, really?
A lot of that has to do with the fact that Valery Gergiev visits the Met. He's a permanent visiting conductor, so he's championing these works and these champions. So that's taken hold. The original version of Romeo and Juliet is a happy ending.
Happy ending, yeah, right.
He established for the Mark Morris Dance Group. That's on an international tour. There's a lot of his unknown works that are, the lesser-known works that are now getting performed owing to the activities of another conductor named Yurovsky. But basically, I think his legacy will always be, first of all, because of Peter and the Wolf,
yeah.
the first composer many of us get to know,
yeah.
Which is a happy thing. He's among the most popular composers of the 20th century,
mm-hmm.
Owing to the fact that his gift for melody is unmatched
mm-hmm.
in the entire history of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
It's perhaps unmatched except by the composer Mozart.
Mm-hmm.
That gift was something that no one could touch.
Mm-hmm.
That gift was something that all the composers around him just shook their heads at. Even Shostakovich had to recognize that. Yes, Shostakovich was an enormously successful composer,
mm-hmm.
but he just bowed his head at the fact that Prokofiev, that gift is
mm-hmm.
his alone, but nobody
mm-hmm.
else has that.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the thing that characterizes his work. It's a gift for melody. It's something that's most manifest in these works, which are about the fantastic, about fairy tale landscapes, about the mindset of a child.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, his whole career was tragic because he approached the horrors of the 20th century with the mindset of a child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good character.
And that is the, you know, the tale of, you know, his tragic ending.
Yeah, that's a good way to characterize his life, actually, because he, I mean, he is a tragic figure. I mean, he gave it his best shot. I'm not just kind of colloquially.
Question for the moralists among us is whether or not, you know, he authored his own tragedy or whether or not he just, because he walked the other way, he
yeah.
went against the grain. He took the wrong turn on the crossroads of 20th century history.
Yeah, I used to blame people for that, but I've sort of I've given up on that kind of moralism.
He sincerely thought sitting in Paris it's either Hitler or Stalin.
Yeah, right. Yeah, great. Yeah, that's a classic non-choice, isn't it? So anyway, it's been really a pleasure to talk to you, Simon, about this book. It's been great. And let me ask you our final traditional question here on New Books in History, and that is, what is your next project? What are you working on now?
Well, I'm working on another performance project with a colleague of mine in Russia, which is some unknown Shostakovich music,
mm-hmm.
specifically, and this might be hard to believe, the songs and dances that Shostakovich wrote for the secret police. The NKVD, which is the precursor to the KGB, had a song and dance ensemble. And these works aren't performed. I don't think the Shostakovich estate is happy about disseminating them, not perhaps with good reason.
That's great.
But the songs and dances for the secret police will be at some point performed. Aside from that, I'm probably going to do a short popular book on Lena's story.
Yeah, that's great. I would love to read. Yeah, I would love to.
Working with an agent in New York about
that.
Great idea. Aside from that, I'm just doing an essay on Poulenc, who's my other great
yeah.
His Ballet Lébiche.
Well, when you finish the Lena book, I would love to have you back on to talk about it, because she is a really fascinating character, and I would appreciate a few more words about her. And I should say that for anybody interested in Prokofiev's life or Soviet history or, you know, good writing about music and history, this is a terrific readable book, and I hope that it finds a wide audience.
Thank you very much.
Certainly. Well, thank you, Simon, for being on the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
Michael.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Simon Morrison about his new book, The People's Artist, Prokofiev's Soviet Years. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. Hope you have a great week.